a different model of quantum computation called the cluster state model. But before we do that, I just wanted to wrap everything up with spontaneous parametric downconversion. So I've already showed you that spontaneous parametric downconversion can be used to generate a number of different interesting states of light. So the heralded single photon states, they can make also squeezed vacuum states and photon subtracted squeezed vacuum states, which are good approximations to these Schrodinger cat states, or Schrodinger kitten states because they're small cats. But one of the I should have made that joke earlier. Anyway, one of the main uses for spontaneous parametric downconversion is to actually create entangled photons. So in the previous lectures, we were talking about trying to disentangle them spectrally so that each photon is pure. But here we actually want to deliberately entangle them, because then we can use the output as a source of Bell pairs, which then can be used as a resource in quantum information protocols. So the multimode analysis that we did was all done in one dimension, in Z, but it's possible to organize things so that the light comes out in a cone like this. So the interaction here has to satisfy energy conservation, but momentum conservation as well, which is why you kind of get this cone shape. So the sum of the momentum in that direction and that direction adds up to the initial momentum of the light. And so in type 1 downconversion, you can set things up so that you get one cone and the correlated pairs come out on opposite ends of the cone. But what you can do is take two really thin slices of the crystal and rotate one of them by 90 degrees. And then if you put in a state that's a super, well, if you put in a classical pump that's an analog of a superposition of V plus H, and you make sure that these are thin enough so that the cones coming out of each one overlap each other enough so that they're within each other's coherence length, then you can pick out pairs from, you know, one place in the cone, and the state that you get out is going to be an entangled state that's either HH or VV, because you can't distinguish between whether the light came out of the horizontal cone or the vertical cone. And because it's a coherent process, then you're going to have a coherent superposition. Another way to do it, which was the original proposal, is to look at type 2 downconversion. And what you can do is set it up in such a way that you get two cones coming out. So one cone is the horizontal cone, and the other cone is the vertical cone. And if I just look at a cross-section of these two cones, you get something that looks like that. And the way that the pairs are correlated is kind of weird here, because you always have a correlation between one photon in one cone and another photon in another cone. So this guy, its partner is going to be in this over here, because we need to satisfy momentum conservation. This guy, his partner is going to be here. But then you also get a situation where the vertical photon from that ring has a horizontal partner at this point in the ring. But then you also have a horizontal photon from this ring having a partner, vertical partner from that ring. And so if you just select on the pairs that are generated at the cross section of these rings, then you can get out a state that looks like this, which is a superposition of HV plus VH. So this was the original proposal by Paul Quiert, but then later on they were able to show that using this type of setup, you can get much higher pair generation rates. So people use this as well. Are there any questions about that? If not, then let's move on to the cluster state quantum computation. So this model of computation goes by a number of different names. It's sometimes known as measurement-based quantum computation, because after you've set up your entangled state, then the entire computation is done just by making measurements. It's also sometimes known as the one-way model of computation. And that's because the measurements that you make make it an irreversible process. So you can only go in one direction rather than in the other direction. And that's actually the name of the title of the paper where this model of computation was introduced, which was by Rausendorf and Briegel. It's a PRL and it's pretty dense. So if you're actually wanting to learn about this model from scratch, I really recommend this paper by Michael Nielsen. So that's the same Nielsen as the textbook Nielsen and Trang. And he wrote a really nice review that you can find on the archive as well. And that's the paper on which I'm basing most of this lecture. Okay, so there are many ways in which you could imagine modeling computation using quantum mechanics. And to date, every single physically plausible model that has been proposed has been shown to be computationally equivalent. So that means that each of these models can efficiently simulate the other model. And that also means that the computational classes that each of these, that the computational classes of the problems that each of these models can solve are all equivalent. And so the one that you guys are most familiar with is this circuit-based model. But here we're going to look at this other model. So let's just start by writing down how a cluster computation would work. So I've already mentioned this, but we begin with the preparation. Of a special entangled many-qubit quantum state. And it's this many-qubit quantum state that's known as the cluster state. And once we've prepared this, then we do an adaptive sequence of single qubit measurements. And so these adaptive measurements, they process the information, and then at the end, they use to read out the result of the computation. So for example, we can look at the following six-qubit cluster state. So I'll just draw it and then I'll explain what it is. Okay, so this is a graph, and the cluster state that corresponds to this graph can be defined as follows, that we prepare each of these qubits in the state plus, and then we apply a CZ operation at every point in time where we see a line joining the qubits. So we can define this cluster saying we prepare each qubit in the plus state. And then two, we apply a CZ gate. Between the qubits whose corresponding graph vertices are connected. And so just to define the CZ operation, it takes the basis state XY to the basis state XY, but if X or Y, X and Y are both one, then we also get a phase at the front. And so what's really weird to me is that in the literature, so in this paper by Michael Nielsen, as well as a bunch of other papers on this, they keep calling this a C phase gate, but if you, but it's still defined this way. But if you go back to Michael Nielsen's book, I think I gave this to you guys, it was a printout of all of the different gates. So if you look there, the C phase gate actually puts an I here, not a minus one. So the nomenclature can be a little bit confusing. But if you do go back to this paper, I just wanted to warn you that they call this a C phase, but I'm going to call it a CZ in this lecture. And so the thing to note is that the CZ, all of them commute, so you can do them in any order you like, or you can just do them all at the same time, it doesn't matter. So that's how you prepare the cluster. At least in theory, that's how you prepare the cluster, but it's how you would define it. Okay, and then we want to perform measurements. So these measurements are going to be single qubit measurements. And the choice of basis may depend on the outcome. Of a previous measurement. So that means that we're going to have some classical feed forward. So we get some sort of measurement outcome on one qubit, and then we feed forward that information to the next qubit to decide which measurement we're going to make. And then three, the measurement result may be processed by a classical computer. So that means that the basis choice may be some complicated function of all of the previous measurement results from the earlier measurements. Okay, so let's look at a concrete example of how this would go. I'll redraw this cluster state. Okay, so what we have here, These operations are unitary operations, and they define the basis in which we perform the measurement. And so you can see all of them are some sort of rotation about the z-axis. Let me just try and get this straight. But because of the Hadamard, what's actually happening is that all of the measurements are being performed in the xy plane. So it's always some sort of vector pointing in the xy plane, that, and it's characterized by this angle alpha. So anytime you make a measurement along the z-axis, that actually deletes qubits from the cluster. So it just breaks these links. So that's one way you can get rid of qubits if you want to. But if you want to actually make a measurement for processing, you have to measure in the xy plane. And so that's what we've got here. And so these numbers here define the order in which the measurements need to be made. So these qubits have to be measured first. But if both of them have the same integer, then they can be measured, you know, one or the other or at the same time. But both of these have to be measured first. And then depending on the measurement outcome, you then choose the basis, whether it's plus or minus alpha 2 or plus or minus beta 2. So these qubits would represent the processing measurements. And then these final qubits would be the output of the computation. So you can either think of this as being a quantum mechanical output, or you can then just measure this in the computational basis and get some sort of binary string that you consider to be the output of the computation. Okay, so that's an example of a cluster. And now I want to show you how we can simulate the circuits that you know from the circuit model using a particular cluster state computation. So the key idea underlying the simulation is something that's known as one-bit teleportation. So the circuit for that would look like this. We have some sort of state psi, which is our arbitrary state, and an ancillary qubit in the plus state. Then we apply a CZ gate. And then apply a Hadamard and a rotation of about the z-axis of theta, and then measure in the computational basis. So we get an outcome 0, 1. And if we do that, then the state of this qubit is projected into something that looks like x to the power of m hz theta psi. And so x is going to depend on whether we get the outcome 0 and 1. So you might wonder why are we doing this, but it's something that we're going to use later on. So just to show you why that's the case, we can see it as follows. So if we write down psi is equal to alpha 0 plus beta 1, and then we take the combined input state, psi and plus, and then we act the CZ gate and the Hadamard gate. Sorry, I think I've jumped ahead of myself. This is supposed to be much more simple than what I wrote. Okay, all we're doing is just applying the Hadamard And then what we get out is the initial state with a Hadamard, and then this X conditional on the measurement outcome. So if we apply the CZ gate and the Hadamard, we get something that looks like A plus plus, alpha plus plus, plus beta minus minus. And then you can just rewrite this. As something that looks like this, and so you can see now if I measure the out measure the first qubit to be zero, then I'm projected into a state with a Hadamard applied to the initial state. If I get the outcome one, then I get something that's the Hadamard applied to the initial state multiplied by the X operator. So that's why we have an x to the power of m here. Yes. Plus one tensor x. Sorry, it's not a ket. It looks like a ket, doesn't it? Yeah. This is, I don't know how to. I've had the confusion the other way, where students are like, what are all of these X's that you're drawing? But it's the first time that I've had the confusion in that direction. Okay, and then we can generalize this to the circuit that I accidentally drew before. And the way that we can convince ourselves that that is true is because the Z rotation commutes with the CZ operation. And so you can just think of this as being a Z theta acting on the initial state. So now we can just consider Z theta to be the input of this circuit. And so then what we get is Z theta times the same thing that was happening here. Great. And so we're going to use this to explain how the cluster state can simulate a quantum computation. So let's just begin by simulating this simple circuit. Actually, I'm going to put a little one here, because I'm going to refer back to that. Okay, so let's say we have a circuit where our initial state is the plus state, and then we want to apply H Z alpha 1, and then H Z alpha 2. And so then the output state that we get looks like this. And so it's a simple circuit, but at least for the single qubit case, we don't lose any generality by just considering these gates, because this combination can be used to implement any arbitrary single qubit operation. Okay, so then the corresponding cluster is this. So schematically, it might kind of look similar. I'm just, you know, drawing the same gates and so on. But conceptually, it's very different because here I'm preparing one single qubit and then applying operations to it. Here I'm preparing this three-qubit entangled state, and then I'm simply measuring in a basis. So measuring in this basis and then measuring in that basis. And then I get an outcome here that is supposed to be corresponding to this. So let's just show that that's actually the case. So even though I'm saying that this cluster computation is simulating this circuit, we can actually draw the circuit for this entire cluster state computation by saying that we prepare our three qubits in the plus state. Then we apply the CZ gates, so that's to create these bonds. And then we're making a measurement in the basis HZ alpha 1. So the way that we measure in a particular basis is we apply a rotation before a measurement in a computational basis. And then based on the outcome, we're going to apply the operation HZ plus or minus alpha 2. So this can be M equals 0, 1. And then we again measure in the computational basis. So is everyone clear with that doing something like this? So a unitary operation followed by computational measurement just means that I'm making a measurement in a basis corresponding to that unitary? Yeah, good. Yeah, we'll deal with that. Yep. Okay, so now I'm just going to redraw this circuit, not because it's ugly, even though it is, but I'll redraw it so that I delay the operations on the second and third qubit until after the measurement of the first qubit. And that's totally fine to do because they all commute and they're on different qubits. So we have our plus, plus, plus. And just the CZ gate on the first two qubits, followed by the basis change, followed by computational basis measurement. Then the C sign on those two qubits. So you can see that it's the same circuit. I've just kind of shifted things along. And the reason I've done that is because now I can identify this as being one circuit, and this as being another circuit. And both of those are equivalent to exactly this circuit. So we know how, so we know what the output is going to be at this point in time because that circuit is just given by that circuit. And then we take that output as the input to the same circuit again, and then we can look at what the output is going to be here. Okay, and we get something that looks like XM2 Hadamard Z plus or minus alpha 2. And so you can see this output does depend on the measurement outcomes, M1 and M2. But we can use feed forward to choose the sign of plus or minus alpha 2, depending on the outcome 1. So use feed forward to choose sign of plus or minus alpha 2, so that we have this. So Z plus or minus alpha 2 XM1 is equal to XM1 Z alpha 2. And notice that there is no plus here. So this is not, it's not an equality in the sense that you can show that this is equal to that, but you can show that you can replace this with that with some sort of conditional feed forward. And it's actually, it's not tricky to show, but there's kind of, I know, like I was trying to show this last night and I couldn't get it to work, but fortunately I got it to work this morning. But we can go through this in the tutorial as well, because it's kind of neat to see how that's the case. And then also, we note that we have this identity or this relationship. So that's actually a proper equality. Like that's actually true. So if I make those replacements, then I can rewrite this state as XM2 ZM1 H Z alpha 2 H Z alpha 1 plus. So the output that we get there is indeed the output of that original circuit that we were trying to simulate, but it's also at the end multiplied by some Pauli matrices, and we know whether to do that multiplication or not depending on the outcomes of these measurements M1 and M2. Okay, so this can be generalized to larger circuits containing single qubits, but it can also be generalized to multi-qubit circuits. So for example, the following circuit. Or I should say, the following circuit. So if I wanted to simulate this two-qubit circuit, then the cluster corresponding to that is going to be this cluster that I drew up earlier. And you can kind of see how it would be the case. But even though there we're preparing two qubits and doing our entangling operation on those qubits here, we prepare this six-qubit cluster beforehand. So that might be something we don't know how to do reliably all the time, but we can just keep trying to prepare this cluster until we have one And then once we have this cluster, it's simply a case of just making these single qubit measurements. Okay, so now I just wanted to give you some examples of common gates that you might be familiar with. So if we wanted to do a two-qubit entangling gate, which is this the C-naught in this case, then we would need 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 15, a 15-qubit cluster state. I'm kind of cheating here because the cluster that I'm preparing is consists of starting each one of these qubits in the plus state, but these two qubits are actually going to be the initial state that we're trying to apply the C-naught on. But that's just for pedagogical reasons. There are ways that you could just create the cluster and then imprint the initial state onto the beginning of the computation. But let's say that we do have the initial states in these qubits, then the operations that we perform are x, 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 and y, 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 y. And all of those can be done in any order or simultaneously. And then at the end, what you get out here is going to be the output of a control NOT gate. We can also do an arbitrary rotation. So that would be a 5-qubit cluster, where again, we're starting the initial state here. Then you perform an X on the initial state, and then measure in the plus or minus eta basis, epsilon, eta, and xi. And so this angle just represents the angle in the xy plane of the measurement basis. We can also do a Hadamard gate. Which is another 5-qubit gate. So x, y, y, y. And just the final example that I want to give you is the pion 2 phase gate. Which again is a 5-qubit gate. Or 5-qubit cluster, I mean. So we'll have x, x on these qubits, and then y on this qubit. So these are all kind of, simple operations that you can do. And it might kind of be difficult to imagine how an actual, full-on computation would look. But there's a nice example of this in the paper by Rausendorf and Briegel, and I redrew it beforehand. So I just don't want to hide all the boards. Okay, so what you would do is you'd create this massive, this is a 12 by 5 cluster. And so all you need to do is create just a lattice. You don't need to make something that looks awfully complicated, because you might imagine, wanting to do the gates between these two qubits and gates between these two qubits and so on. So you might think you want something really like weird and complicated. But all you need to do is create a two-dimensional lattice like this. And then using the Z operation, the Z measurements, you just simply measure the qubits that you don't want. And so that deletes them from the cluster. And then you're left with something that would correspond to your circuit. And then you can perform your measurements, where the measurement basis here is schematically shown by the orientation of this arrow. So you're performing all of your measurements. If you want to do entangling operations between qubits, then you perform some measurements on a line joining these qubits and so on. So this would be a three-qubit operation where you do two-qubit entangling gates. Okay, so I just wanted to give you guys a couple of properties of cluster states. You might hope that that something like this, a cluster state, might be naturally occurring, so that it would be like a ground state of some sort of physical Hamiltonian. But in this paper by Mike Nielsen, he actually proved that the cluster state doesn't correspond to the ground state of any physically reasonable Hamiltonian that has two-body interactions. So that's kind of disappointing. Another thing that he showed was that if you just have a linear cluster state, then that can be efficiently simulated by a classical computer. So linear clusters won't give you any computational advantage. It needs to be a two-dimensional cluster to get some sort of computational advantage. So if these cluster states aren't the ground states of physically reasonable Hamiltonians, how would we make them? Well, one way is to prepare a whole bunch of qubits and then apply a Ising type interaction. So let me write this down. So imagine that you've got some sort of lattice of spins, and they have this nearest neighbor interaction. Where the interaction strength is given by G, and it's something that you can vary. And then the interaction is over the sum of nearest neighbors. And a couple is the Z spins. So what you can do is take that operation, that interaction, and well, first you prepare all of your spins in the plus state. And then we switch on the interaction. For a time capital T, such that we induce a pi phase shift. And so what that does is, in one step, it entangles all of the nearest neighbors in the lattice and gives you something that looks like this two-dimensional cluster state. Alternatively, in optics, you can do this probabilistically. So there are these things that were introduced called fusion gates, introduced by Dan Brown and Terry Rudolph. And so fusion gates rely rely on having a resource of small clusters that you can then fuse together to make larger clusters. So, for example, if you have two clusters like this, and you apply a fusion gate to these two nodes, then you can get them to combine into something like this. Or you can create two-dimensional clusters as well. So if you fuse these two qubits together, you can get something like this. And fortunately, we do have a resource of these two-qubit clusters because these are just EPR states, and they're what we get from parametric down conversion. So if we create this pair of entangled photons, we're going to have something that's HH plus VV. Oh, I think we have to do. Oh, there's some like operation, I think, unitary. Yeah, no. Now I'm not so certain. Because, okay, so the thing that we want here is something that looks like 0, 0 plus 1. So that's not exactly an EPR pair, but I think there's some simple relationship between those two. But I can double check that before the tutorial. But I'm pretty sure you can create two-qubit clusters using a down conversion source, and then using these fusion gates, you can combine them to create larger clusters. But this is a really, it's a probabilistic process. And of course, the more and more of these probabilistic things that you do, the less likely your probability of success is. So it's not very viable, but at least proof of principle experiments have been done with that. Okay, let me just give you a reference for that. Okay, and then there was a more recent proposal from maybe a year and a half ago, also from Terry Rudolph's group, where they assume that they have a resource of GHZ states, and they now use these enhanced fusion gates. So the current fusion gates, the previous fusion gates worked with a success probability of a half, but now these enhanced fusion gates that work with a probability of 3/4. And so using that in combination with having a bunch of GHZ states, which, so I'm talking specifically about 3-qubit GHZ states. So they're states that look like that. Then you can build up what they're calling a ballistic cluster state. So it's this three-dimensional lattice. And it's made out of photons, so of course it's going to be propagating through space. And so the way that it works is you have on this side kind of a plate that's the source of the lattice, and so it's just spitting out this lattice that's continuously moving along. And then on this side you have the detector, and then as the photons fly from here to there, they're being processed and the computation is going on, and then they're being measured on the other side. So there's this proposal. And then one more thing I want to say is also there was a proposal, actually Nick's old supervisor, Nick Menicucci, came up with this idea that if you have a down conversion source inside a cavity, then you can get these frequency cones, and each one of these frequencies can represent a different qubit. And so if you have a really, really good cavity, you can create a large number of these frequency cones So based on that proposal, Olivia Pfister's group was able to experimentally create a 60-mode dual rail cluster state, so that's 60 qubits. It's the largest entangled state that's ever been created, and this was done a couple of years ago. And they, based on the analysis of their experimental setup, they think they can get up to 6,700 qubits in an entangled state. So that's in frequency combs. So that's Chen et al. So 60 modes. So yes, Etienne.
Even if you can create like an insanely large amount of entangled qubits, that doesn't mean you can like reliably control them.
Yeah. Yeah, so this proposal, I mean, I've just sketched it out very roughly, but they incorporate things like errors and decoherence and find thresholds for what losses you can tolerate in order for it to work. And I think he was saying something like, using percolation theory, they can, like if you imagine you have this three-dimensional cluster and it's got all of these missing qubits, you know, let's say due to loss, you can still figure out that there's a certain loss threshold that you can tolerate as long as you can find some line in three dimensions that you can join from the top to bottom. And they even have an algorithm that I think it can, it only needs to see 10 qubits in advance to be able to reliably find a path. So in this three-dimensional ballistic cluster that's traveling, as long as it's got 10 qubits in front of it, it can kind of reliably find a path to go from one end to the other. And I guess you need to do that for each qubit. So they have ways of compensating for this. But definitely, yeah, you need to be able to tolerate all sorts of things for it to work reliably. Okay, so I guess we can wrap up. So I wanted to show you that there is this other new, really different model of quantum computation, which is kind of exciting because it's given people a new way of thinking about how computation works, and it's allowed people to focus on different types of optical systems. So one of the problems in optics, for example, is doing these entangling gates. So you might think that optics is not really a viable architecture for quantum computing because these KLM protocols, you know, just need insane amounts of resources. But maybe if you have some sort of way of probabilistically generating these states offline, it might make some architectures more viable than others. So it's allowed people to investigate different types of approaches and inspired new types of experiments. And it's kind of cool thinking about it from this perspective. And I've shown you that there are a few proposals that exist in optics and other spin systems. So I just wanted to wrap up the whole week, just to remind you of everything that we've done. So on Monday, we had an introduction to quantum optics and nonlinear optics, and that kind of set the stage for us to be able to do a really thorough analysis of spectral correlations in downconversion sources. And then yesterday we looked at coherent state implementations of linear optical quantum computing. So that's a different way of encoding qubits rather than single photons. It's in these coherent coherent states of light. And of course today, yeah, we discussed the cluster state model. So I guess I'll finish off with asking if there are any questions about any of those things. If not, then I'll see you guys at the tutorial this afternoon.